our being part of it, on our being situated within it. In order to use a geographical map, it is not enough to look at it from the outside. We must know where we are situated in relation to what it represents. In order to understand our experience of space, it is not enough to think of Newtonian space. We must remember that we see this space from inside it, that we are localized. In order to understand time, it is not enough to think of it from outside. It is necessary to understand that we, in every moment of our experience, are situated within time. We observe the universe from within it, interacting with a minuscule portion of the innumerable variables of the cosmos. What we see is a blurred image. This blurring suggests that the dynamic of the universe with which we interact is governed by entropy, which measures the amount of blurring. It measures something that relates to us more than to the cosmos. We are getting up dangerously close to ourselves. We can almost hear Tiresias and Oedipus saying, "Stop, or you will find yourself." Or Hildegard of Bingen, who in the 12th century seeks the absolute and ends up by putting universal man at the center of the cosmos. But, before getting to this us, another chapter is required, to show how the growth in entropy, perhaps only an effect of perspective, might give rise to the entire vast phenomenon of time. Let me summarize the hard ground covered in the last two chapters in the hope that I have not already lost all my readers. At the fundamental level, the world is a collection of events not ordered in time. These events manifest relations between physical variables that are a priori on the same level. Each part of the world interacts with a small part of all the variables, the value of which determines the state of the world with regard to that particular subsystem. A small system, S, does not distinguish the details of the rest of the universe because it interacts only with a few among the variables of the rest of the universe. The entropy of the universe with respect to S counts the microstates of the universe undistinguishable by S. The universe appears in a high entropy configuration with respect to S because, by definition, there are more microstates in high entropy configurations, and therefore it is more likely to happen to be in one of these microstates. As explained above, there is a flow associated with high entropy configurations, and the parameter of this flow is thermal time. For a generic small system S, entropy remains generally high along the entire flow of thermal time. Perhaps just fluctuating up and down, because after all, we are dealing here with probabilities, not fixed rules. But among the innumerable small systems S that exist in this extraordinarily vast universe where we happen to live, there will be a few special ones, for which the fluctuations of the entropy happen to be such that at one of the two ends of the flow of thermal time, entropy happens to be low. For these systems S, the fluctuation is not symmetrical. Entropy increases. This growth is what we experience as the flowing of time. What is special is not the state of the early universe. It is the small system S to which we belong. I'm not sure if we are dealing with a plausible story, but I do not know of any better ones. The alternative is to accept as a given of observation the fact that entropy was low at the beginning of the universe and to leave it at that. It is the law announced by Clausius. Delta S is always greater than or equal to zero, and deciphered by Boltzmann that is guiding us. Entropy never decreases. Having lost sight of it in search of the general laws of the world, we rediscover it as a possible perspective effect for particular subsystems. Let's begin again from there. Chapter 11. What emerges from a particularity? Why do the tall pine and the pale poplar intertwine their branches to provide such sweet shade for us? Why does the fleeting water invent bright spirals in the turbulent stream? Book 2, Ode 9. It is entropy, not energy, that drives the world. At school I was told that it is energy that makes the world go round. We need to get energy, for example, from petroleum, from the sun, or from nuclear sources. Energy makes our engines run, helps plants to grow, and causes us to wake up every morning full of vitality. But there is something that does not add up. Energy, as we are told at school, is conserved. It is neither created nor destroyed. If it is conserved, why do we have to constantly resupply it? Why can't we just keep using the same energy? The truth is that there is plenty of energy, and it is not consumed. It's not energy that the world needs in order to keep going. What it needs is low entropy. Energy, be it mechanical, chemical, electrical, or potential, transforms itself into thermal energy, that is to say, into heat. It goes into cold things, and there is no free way of getting it back from there to reuse it to make a plant grow or to power a motor. In this process, the energy remains the same, but the entropy increases. And it is this which cannot be turned back. The second law of thermodynamics demands it. What makes the world go round are not sources of energy, but sources of low entropy. Without low entropy, energy would dilute into uniform heat and the world would go to sleep in a state of thermal equilibrium. There would no longer be any distinction between past and future, and nothing would happen. Near to the Earth, we have a rich source of low entropy, the Sun. The Sun sends us hot photons. Then the Earth radiates heat towards the black sky, emitting colder photons. The energy that enters is more or less equal to the energy that exits. Consequently, we do not generally gain energy in the exchange. Gaining energy in the exchange is disaster for us. It is global warming. But for every hot photon that arrives, the Earth emits 10 cold ones, since a hot photon from the Sun has the same energy as 10 cold photons emitted by the Earth. The hot photon has less entropy than the 10 cold photons because the number of configurations of a single hot photon is lower than the number of configurations of 10 cold photons. Therefore, the Sun is a continual rich source of low entropy for us. We have at our disposal an abundance of low entropy, and it is this that allows plants and animals to grow, enables us to build motors and cities, and to think and to write books such as this one. Where does the low entropy of the Sun come from? From the fact that, in turn, the Sun is born out of an entropic configuration that was even lower. The primordial cloud, from which the solar system was formed, had even lower entropy, and so on back into the past, until we reach the extremely low initial entropy of the universe. It is the growth of this entropy that powers the great story of the cosmos. But the increase in the entropy of the universe is not rapid, like the sudden expansion of gas in a box. It is gradual. It takes time. Even with a gigantic ladle, it takes time to stir something as big as the universe. Above all, there are obstacles and closed doors to its growth, passages where it occurs only with great difficulty. A pile of wood, for example, lasts a long time if left alone. It is not in a state of maximum entropy because the elements of which it is made, such as carbon and hydrogen, are combined in a very particular manner, ordered to give form to the wood. Entropy grows if these particular combinations are broken down. This is what happens when wood burns. Its elements disengage from the particular structures that form wood, and entropy increases sharply, far being, in fact, a markedly irreversible process. But the wood does not start to burn on its own. It remains for a long time in a state of low entropy until something opens a door that allows it to pass to a state of higher entropy. A pile of wood is in an unstable state, like a pack of cards. But until something comes along to make it do so, it does not collapse. This something might, for instance, be a match to light a flame. The flame is a process that opens a channel through which the wood can pass into a state of higher entropy. There are situations which impede and hence slow down the increase of entropy throughout the universe. In the past, for instance, the universe was largely an immense expanse of hydrogen. Hydrogen can fuse into helium, and helium has a higher entropy than hydrogen. But for this to happen, it is necessary for a channel to be opened. A star must ignite for hydrogen to begin to burn there into helium. What causes stars to ignite? Another process that increases entropy. The contraction due to gravity of one of the large clouds of hydrogen that sail through the galaxy. A contracted cloud of hydrogen has higher entropy than a dispersed one. But the clouds of hydrogen are so vast that they take millions of years to contract. Only after they become concentrated do they manage to heat up to the point that triggers the process of nuclear fission. The ignition of nuclear fission opens the door that allows the further increase in entropy. Hydrogen burning into helium. The entire history of the universe consists of this halting and leaping cosmic growth of entropy. It is neither rapid nor uniform because things remain trapped in basins of low entropy, the pile of wood, the cloud of hydrogen, until something opens a door onto a process that finally allows entropy to increase. The growth of entropy itself happens to open new doors through which entropy can increase further. A dam in the mountains, for instance, retains water until it is gradually worn down over time, and the freed water escapes downhill once again, causing entropy to grow. Over the course of this irregular trajectory, large or small portions of the universe remain isolated in relatively stable situations for periods that can be very prolonged. Living beings are made up of similarly intertwined processes. Photosynthesis deposits low entropy from the sun into plants. Animals feed on low entropy by eating. If all we needed was energy rather than entropy, we would head for the heat of the Sahara rather than towards our next meal. Inside every living cell, the complex web of chemical processes is a structure that opens and closes gates through which low entropy can increase. Molecules function as the catalysts that allow the processes to intertwine, or conversely, they put a brake on them. The increase of entropy in each individual process is what makes the whole thing work. Life is this network of processes for increasing entropy. Processes which act as catalysts to each other. It isn't true, as is sometimes stated, that life generates structures that are particularly ordered or that locally diminish entropy. It is simply a process that degrades and consumes the low entropy of food. It is a self-structured disordering, no more and no less than in the rest of the universe. Even the most banal phenomena are governed by the second law of thermodynamics. A stone falls to the ground. Why? One often reads that it's because the stone places itself in a state of lower energy that it ends up lower down. But why does the stone put itself in a state of lower energy? Why should it lose energy if energy is conserved? The answer is that when the stone hits the earth, it warms it. Its mechanical energy is transformed into heat, and there is no way back from there. If the second law of thermodynamics did not exist, if heat did not exist, if there existed no microscopic swarming, the stone would rebound perpetually. It would never land and be still. It is entropy, not energy, that keeps stones on the ground and the world turning. The entire coming into being of the cosmos is a gradual process of disordering, like the pack of cards that begins in order and then becomes disordered through shuffling. There are no immense hands that shuffle the universe. It does this mixing by itself, in the interactions between its parts that open and close during the course of the mixing, step by step. Vast regions remain trapped in configurations that remain ordered, until here and there, new channels are opened through which disorder spreads. What causes events to happen in the world, what writes its history, is the irresistible mixing of all things, going from the few ordered configurations to the countless disordered ones. The entire universe is like a mountain that collapses in slow motion, like a structure that very gradually crumbles. From the most minute events to the more complex ones, it is this dance of ever-increasing entropy nourished by the initial low entropy of the universe, that is the real dance of Shiva, the destroyer. Traces and causes. The fact that entropy has been low in the past leads to an important fact that is ubiquitous and crucial for the difference between past and future. The past leaves traces of itself in the present. Traces are everywhere. The craters of the moon testify to impacts in the past. Fossils show the forms of living creatures from long ago. Telescopes show how far off galaxies were in the past. Books contain our history. Our brains swarm with memories. Traces of the past exist, and not traces of the future, only because entropy was low in the past. There can be no other reason, since the only source of the difference between past and future is the low entropy of the past. In order to leave a trace, it is necessary for something to become arrested, to stop moving, and this can only happen in an irreversible process, that is to say, by degrading energy into heat. In this way, computers heat up, the brain heats up, the meteors that fall into the moon heat it. Even the goose quill of a medieval scribe in a Benedictine abbey heats a little the page on which he writes. In a world without heat, everything would rebound elastically, leaving no trace. It is the presence of abundant traces of the past that produces the familiar sensation that the past is determined. The absence of any analogous traces of the future produces the sensation that the future is open. The existence of traces serves to make it possible for our brain to dispose of extensive maps of past events. There is nothing analogous to this for future ones. This fact is at the origin of our sensation of being able to act freely in the world, choosing between different futures, even though we are unable to act upon the past. The vast mechanisms of the brain, about which we have no direct awareness. I know not why I am so sad, mumbles Antonio at the beginning of The Merchant of Venice. Have been designed during the course of evolution in order to make calculations about possible futures. This is what we call deciding. Since they elaborate possible alternative futures that would follow if the present were exactly as it is except for some detail, we are naturally inclined to think in terms of causes that precede effects. The cause of a future event is a past event such that the future event would not follow in a world that was exactly the same except for this cause. In our experience, the notion of cause is thus asymmetrical in time. Cause precedes effect. When we recognize in particular that two events have the same cause, we find this common cause in the past, not in the future. If two waves of a tsunami arrive together at two neighboring islands, we think that there has been an event in the past that has caused both. We do not look for it in the future. But this does not happen because there is a magical force of causality going from the past to the future. It happens because the improbability of a correlation between two events requires something improbable, and it is only the low entropy of the past that provides such improbability. What else could? In other words, the existence of common causes in the past is nothing but a manifestation of low entropy in the past. In a state of thermal equilibrium, or in a purely mechanical system, there isn't a direction to time identified by causality. The laws of elementary physics do not speak of causes, but only of regularities, and these are symmetrical with regard to past and future. Bertrand Russell noted this in a famous article, writing emphatically that the law of causality is a relic of a bygone age, surviving like the monarchy only because it is erroneously supposed to do no harm. He exaggerates, of course, because the fact that there are no causes at an elementary level is not a sufficient reason to render obsolete the very notion of cause. At an elementary level, there are no cats either, but we do not for this reason cease to bother with cats. The low entropy of the past renders the notion of cause an effective one. But memory, causes, and effects, flow, the determined nature of the past, and the indeterminacy of the future are nothing but names that we give to the consequences of a statistical fact. The improbability of a past state of the universe. Causes, memory, traces, the history itself of the becoming of the world that unfolds not only across centuries and millennia of human history, but in the billions of years of the great cosmic narrative. All this stems simply from the fact that the configuration of things was particular a few billion years ago. And particular is a relative term. It is particular in relation to a perspective. It is a blurring. It is determined by the interactions that a physical system has with the rest of the world. Hence, causality, memory, traces, the history of the happening of the world itself can only be an effect of perspective. Like the turning of the heavens. An effect of our peculiar point of view in the world. Inexorably, then, the study of time does nothing but return us to ourselves. Chapter 12. The Scent of the Madeleine. Happy and master of himself is the man who for every day of his life can say, "Today I have lived." Tomorrow, if God extends for us a horizon of dark clouds or designs a morning of limpid light, he will not change our poor past. He will do nothing without the memory of events that the fleeting hour will have assigned to us. Book 3, Ode 29. Let us turn to ourselves, then, and to the role we play in relation to the nature of time. Above all else, what are we as human beings? Entities? But the world is not made up of entities. It is made from events that combine with each other. So what then am I? In the Milindapana, a Buddhist text written in Pali in the first century of our era, Nagasena replies to the questions of King Milinda, denying his existence as an entity. King Milinda says to the sage Nagasena, "What is your name, master?" The teacher replies, "I am called Nagasena, O great king. Nagasena is nothing but a name, a designation, an expression, a simple word. There is no person here." The king is astonished by such an extreme-sounding assertion. "If no person exists, who is it then who has clothing and sustenance? Who lives according to the virtues? Who kills? Who steals? Who has pleasures? Who lies? If there is no longer an actor, neither is there good or evil any longer." And he argues that the subject must be an autonomous being that is not reducible to its component parts. "Is it the hairs that are Nagasena, master? Is it the nails or the teeth or the flesh or the bones? Is it the name? Is it the sensations, the perceptions, the consciousness? Is it none of these things?" The sage replies that Nagasena is effectively none of these things, and the king seems to have won the discussion. If Nagasena is none of these, then he must be something else. And this something else will be the person Nagasena, who therefore exists. But the sage turns his own argument against him, asking what a chariot consists of. Are the wheels the chariot? Is the axle? Is the chassis the chariot? Is the chariot the sum of its parts? The king replies cautiously that certainly chariot refers only to the relationship between the ensemble of wheels, axle, and chassis, to their working together and in relation to us, and that there does not exist an entity chariot beyond these relations and events. Nagasena triumphs. In the same way as chariot, the name Nagasena designates nothing more than a collection of relations and events. We are processes, events, composite and limited in space and time. But if we are not an individual entity, what is it that founds our identity and its unity? What makes it so that I am Carlo, and that my hair and my nails and my feet are considered part of me, as well as my anger and my dreams, and that I consider myself to be the same Carlo as yesterday, the same as tomorrow, the one who thinks, suffers, and perceives? There are different ingredients that combine to produce our identity. Three of these are important for the argument of this book. One. The first is that every one of us identifies with a point of view in the world. The world is reflected in each one of us through a rich spectrum of correlations essential for our survival. Each of us is a complex process that reflects the world and elaborates the information we receive in a way that is strictly integrated. Two. The second ingredient on which our identity is based is the same as for the chariot. In the process of reflecting the world, we organize it into entities. We conceive of the world by grouping and segmenting it as best we can, in a continuous process that is more or less uniform and stable, the better to interact with it. We group together into a single entity the rocks that we call Mont Blanc, and we think of it as a unified thing. We draw lines over the world, dividing it into sections. We establish boundaries. We approximate the world by breaking it down into pieces. It is the structure of our nervous system that works in this way. It receives sensory stimuli, elaborates information continuously, generating behavior. It does so through networks of neurons which form flexible dynamic systems that continuously modify themselves, seeking to predict, as far as possible, the flow of information intake. In order to do this, the networks of neurons evolve by associating more or less stable fixed points of their dynamics to recurring patterns that they find in the incoming information, or indirectly in the procedures of elaboration themselves. This is what seems to emerge from the very lively current research on the brain. If this is so, then things like concepts are fixed points in the neuronal dynamic, induced by recurring structures of the sensorial input and of the successive elaborations. They mirror a combination of aspects of the world that depends on recurrent structures of the world and on their relevance in their interactions with us. This is what a chariot consists of. Hume would have been pleased to know about these developments in our understanding of the brain. In particular, we group into a unified image the collection of processes that constitutes those living organisms that are other human beings, because our life is social and we therefore interact a great deal with them. They are knots of cause and effect that are deeply relevant for us. We have shaped an idea of a human being by interacting with others like ourselves. I believe that our notion of self stems from this, not from introspection. When we think of ourselves as persons, I believe we are applying to ourselves the mental circuits that we have developed to engage with our companions. The first image that I have of myself as a child is the child that my mother sees. We are for ourselves in large measure what we see and have seen of ourselves reflected back to us by our friends, our loves, and our enemies. I've never been convinced by the idea attributed to Descartes that the primary aspect of our experience is awareness of thinking and therefore of existing. Even the attribution of the idea to Descartes seems wrong to me. Cogito ergo sum is not the first step in the Cartesian reconstruction. It is the second. The first is dubito ergo cogito. The starting point of the reconstruction is not a hypothetical a priori that is immediate to the experience of existing as a subject. It's a rationalistic a posteriori reflection on the first stage of the process in which Descartes had articulated a state of doubt. Logic dictates that if someone doubts something, they must have thought about it, and that if they can think, then they must exist. It is substantially a consideration made in the third person, not in the first, however private the process. The starting point for Descartes is the methodical doubt experienced by a refined intellectual, not the basic experience of a subject. The experience of thinking of oneself as a subject is not a primary experience. It is a complex cultural deduction made on the basis of many other thoughts. My primary experience, if we grant that this means anything, is to see the world around me, not myself. I believe that we each have a concept of myself only because at a certain point we learn to project onto ourselves the idea of being human as an additional feature that evolution has led us to develop during the course of millennia in order to engage with other members of our group. We are the reflection of the idea of ourselves that we receive back from our kind. 3. But there is a third ingredient in the foundation of our identity, and it is probably the essential one. It is the reason this delicate discussion is taking place in a book about time. Memory. We are not a collection of independent processes in successive moments. Every moment of our existence is linked by a peculiar triple thread to our past, the most recent and the most distant, by memory. Our present swarms with traces of our past. We are histories of ourselves, narratives. I am not this momentary mass of flesh reclined on the sofa typing the letter A on my laptop. I am my thoughts full of the traces of the phrases that I am writing. I am my mother's caresses and the serene kindness with which my father calmly guided me. I am my adolescent travels. I am what my reading has deposited in layers in my mind. I am my loves, my moments of despair, my friendships, what I've written, what I've heard, the faces engraved on my memory. I am, above all, the one who a minute ago made a cup of tea for himself. The one who a moment ago typed the word memory into his computer. The one who just composed the sentence that I am now completing. If all this disappeared, would I still exist? I am this long, ongoing novel. My life consists of it. It is memory that solders together the processes scattered across time of which we are made. In this sense, we exist in time. It is for this reason that I am the same person today as I was yesterday. To understand ourselves means to reflect on time. But to understand time, we need to reflect on ourselves. A recent book devoted to research on the functioning of the brain is entitled Your Brain is a Time Machine. It discusses the many ways in which the brain interacts with the passage of time and establishes bridges between past, present, and future. To a large extent, the brain is a mechanism for collecting memories of the past in order to use them continually to predict the future. This happens across a wide spectrum of different timescales, from the very short to the very long. If someone throws something at us to catch, our hand moves skillfully to the place where the object will be in a few instants. The brain, using past impressions, has very rapidly calculated the future position of the object that is flying towards us. Further along the scale, we plant seed so that corn will grow, or invest in scientific research so that tomorrow it might result in knowledge and new technology. The possibility of predicting something in the future obviously improves our chances of survival, and consequently, evolution has selected the neural structures that allow it. We are the result of this selection. This being between past and future events is central to our mental structure. This, for us, is the flow of time. There are elementary structures in the wiring of our nervous system that immediately register movement. An object that appears in one place and then immediately afterwards in another does not generate two distinct signals that travel separately towards the brain, but a single signal correlated with the fact that we are looking at something that is moving. In other words, what we perceive is not the present, which in any case makes no sense for a system that functions on a scale of finite time, but rather something that happens and extends in time. It is in our brains that an extension in time becomes condensed into a perception of duration. This intuition is an ancient one. St. Augustine's ruminations on it have remained famous. In Book 11 of the Confessions, Augustine asks himself about the nature of time, and despite being interrupted by exclamations in the style of an evangelical preacher that I find quite tiresome, he presents a lucid analysis of our capacity for perceiving time. He observes that we are always in the present, because the past is past and therefore does not exist, and the future has yet to arrive, so it does not exist either. And he asks himself how we can be aware of duration, or even capable of evaluating it, if we are always only in a present, which is, by definition, instantaneous. How can we come to know so clearly about the past, about time, if we are always in the present? Here and now there is no past and no future. Where are they? Augustine concludes that they are within us. It is within my mind, then, that I measure time. I must not allow my mind to insist that time is something objective. When I measure time, I am measuring something in the present of my mind. Either this is time, or I have no idea what time is. The idea is much more convincing than it seems on first reading. We can say that we measure duration with a clock, but to do so requires us to read it at two different moments. This is not possible because we are always in one moment, never in two. In the present, we see only the present. We can see things that we interpret as traces of the past, but there is a categorical difference between seeing traces of the past and perceiving the flow of time. And Augustine realizes that the root of this difference, the awareness of the passing of time, is internal. It is integral to the mind. It is the traces left in the brain by the past. Augustine's exposition of the idea is quite beautiful. It is based on our experience of music. When we listen to a hymn, the meaning of a sound is given by the ones that come before and after it. Music can occur only in time. But if we are always in the present moment, how is it possible to hear it? It is possible, Augustine observes, because our consciousness is based on memory and on anticipation. A hymn, a song, is in some way present in our minds in a unified form, held together by something, by that which we take time to be. And hence this is what time is. It is entirely in the present, in our minds, as memory and as anticipation. The idea that time might exist only in the mind certainly did not become dominant in Christian thought. In fact, it is one of the propositions explicitly condemned as heretical by the Bishop of Paris, Étienne Tompier, in 1277. In his list of beliefs to be condemned, the following can be found. Quod ivum et tempus nihil sunt in re, sed solum in apprehensione. In other words, it is heretical to maintain that the age and time do not exist in reality but only in the mind. Perhaps my book is sliding towards heresy. But given that Augustine continues to be regarded as a saint, I don't suppose that I should be too worried about it. Christianity, after all, is quite flexible. It may seem easy to refute Augustine by arguing that the traces of the past, which he finds within himself, may be there only because they reflect a real structure of the external world. In the 14th century, for instance, William of Ockham maintained in his Philosophiae Naturalis that man observes both the sky's movements and the ones within himself, and therefore perceives time through his coexistence with the world. Centuries later, Husserl insists, rightly, on the distinction between physical time and internal consciousness of time. For a sound naturalist wishing to avoid drowning in the useless vortices of idealism, the former, the physical world, comes first, while the latter, consciousness, independently of how well we understand it, is determined by the first. It is an entirely reasonable objection, just so long as physics reassures us that the external flow of time is real, universal, and in keeping with our intuitions. But if physics shows us instead that such time is not an elementary part of reality, can we continue to overlook Augustine's observation and treat it as irrelevant to the true nature of time? Inquiry into perception of the internal rather than the external nature of time reoccurs frequently in Western philosophy. Kant discusses the nature of space and time in his Critique of Pure Reason, and interprets both space and time as a priori forms of knowledge, that is to say, things that do not just relate to the objective world, but also to the way in which a subject apprehends it. But he also observes that whereas space is shaped by our external sense, that is to say, by our way of ordering things that we see in the world outside of us, time is shaped by our internal sense, that is to say, by our way of ordering internal states within ourselves. Once again, the basis of the temporal structure of the world is to be sought in something that closely relates to our way of thinking and perceiving, to our consciousness. This remains true without having to get tangled up in Kantian transcendentalism. Husserl reprises Augustine when he describes the shaping of experience in terms of retention, using, like him, the metaphor of listening to a melody. The world, in the meantime, has become bourgeois, with melodies replacing hymns. In the moment that we hear a note, the previous note is retained, then that one also becomes part of the retention, and so on, running them together in such a way that the present contains a continuous trace of the past, becoming gradually more blurred. It is by way of this process of retention, according to Husserl, that phenomena constitute time. The interesting point here is that the source of the phenomenology of time is not identified by Husserl in the hypothetical objective succession of phenomena, but rather in memory, similar to anticipation called protension by Husserl. My point is that this continues to be valid in a natural philosophy, even in a physical world where there is no physical time globally organized in a linear way, but only traces generated by varying entropy. In the wake of Husserl, Martin Heidegger writes, as far as my love of the clarity and transparency of Galileo's writing allows me to decipher the deliberate obscurity of Heidegger's language, that time temporalizes itself only to the extent that it is human. For him also, time is the time of mankind, the time for doing, for that with which mankind is engaged. Even if afterwards, since he's interested in what being is for man, for the entity that poses the problem of existence, Heidegger ends up by identifying the internal consciousness of time as the horizon of being itself. These intuitions of the degree to which time is inherent to subjectivity remain significant also to any sound naturalism that sees the subject as part of nature and is not afraid to speak about reality and to study it while at the same time acknowledging that our understanding and our intuition are radically filtered by the way in which that limited instrument, our brain, works. This brain is part of that reality, which consequently depends on the interaction between an external world and the structures with which the mind operates. But the mind is the working of our brain. What little we are beginning to understand of this functioning is that our entire brain operates on the basis of a collection of traces of the past left in the synapses that connect neurons. Synapses are continually formed in their thousands, and then erased, especially during sleep, leaving behind a blurry reflection of that which has acted on our nervous system in the past. A blurred image, no doubt. Think of how many millions of details our eyes see every moment which do not stay in our memory, but one which contains worlds. Boundless worlds. They are those worlds that the young Marcel rediscovers, bewildered every morning, in the first pages of remembrance of things past, in the vertigo of the moment when consciousness emerges like a bubble from unfathomable depths. That world of which vast territories are then revealed to him when the taste of the Madeleine brings back the flavour of Combray. A vast world, a map of which Proust slowly unfolds during the course of the 3,000 pages of his great novel. A novel, it should be noted, that is not a narrative of events in the world, but an account of what's inside the memory of a single person. From the fragrance of the Madeleine at the beginning to the last word, time. Of its final part, time regained, the book is nothing but a disordered, detailed meandering among the synapses of Marcel's brain. Proust finds a limitless space and an incredible throng of details, fragrances, considerations, sensations, reflections, re-elaborations, colours, objects, names, looks, emotions, all within the folds of the brain between the ears of Marcel. This is the flow of time familiar from our experience. It is inside there that it nestles, inside of us, in the utterly crucial presence of traces of the past in our neurons. Proust could not be more explicit on this matter, writing in the first book, "Reality is formed only by memory." And memory, in its turn, is a collection of traces, an indirect product of the disordering of the world, of that small equation written earlier, delta S is always greater than or equal to zero, the one that tells us that the state of the world was in a particular configuration in the past and therefore has left and leaves traces. Particular, that is, perhaps only in relation to rare subsystems. Ourselves included. We are stories, contained within the 20 complicated centimeters behind our eyes, lines drawn by traces left by the remingling together of things in the world and orientated towards predicting events in the future, towards the direction of increasing entropy in a rather particular corner of this immense, chaotic universe. This space, memory, combined with our continuous process of anticipation, is the source of our sensing time as time and ourselves as ourselves. Think about it. Our introspection is easily capable of imagining itself without there being space or matter. But can it imagine itself not existing in time? It is with respect to that physical system to which we belong, due to the peculiar way in which it interacts with the rest of the world, thanks to the fact that it allows traces, and because we, as physical entities, consist of memory and anticipation, that the perspective of time opens up for us, like our small, lit clearing. Time opens up our limited access to the world. Time, then, is the form in which we beings, whose brains are made up essentially of memory and foresight, interact with the world. It is the source of our identity, and of our suffering as well. Buddha summed this up in a few maxims that millions of human beings have adopted as the foundations of their lives. Birth is suffering. Decline is suffering. Illness is suffering. Death is suffering. Union with that which we hate is suffering. Separation from that which we love is suffering. Failure to obtain what we desire is suffering. It's suffering because we must lose what we have and are attached to. Because everything that begins must end. What causes us to suffer is not in the past or the future. It is there now, in our memory, in our expectations. We long for timelessness. We endure the passing of time. We suffer time. Time is suffering. Such is time, and because of this, we are fascinated and troubled by it in equal measure. And perhaps because of this too, dear reader, my brother, my sister, you are holding this book in your hands. Because it is nothing but a fleeting structure of the world, an ephemeral fluctuation in the happening of the world, that which is capable of giving rise to what we are, beings made of time, that to which we owe our being, giving us the precious gift of our very existence, allowing us to create the fleeting illusion of permanence that is the origin of all our suffering. The music of Strauss and the words of Hofmannsthal sing of this with devastating delicacy. I remember a little girl, but how can that be? Once I was that little Resi, and then one day I became an old woman. If God wills it so, why allow me to see it? Why doesn't he hide it from me? Everything is a mystery, such a deep mystery. I feel the fragility of things in time. From the bottom of my heart, I feel we should cling to nothing. Everything slips through our fingers. All that we seek to hold on to dissolves. Everything vanishes like mist and dreams. Time is a strange thing. When we don't need it, it is nothing. Then suddenly, there is nothing else. It is everywhere around us. Also within us. It seeps into our faces. It seeps into the mirror, runs through my temples. Between you and I, it runs silently like an hourglass. Oh, Quinn. Quinn. Sometimes I feel it flowing inexorably. Sometimes I get up in the middle of the night and stop all the clocks. Chapter 13. The Sources of Time. Perhaps God has many more seasons in store for us. Or perhaps the last is to be this winter that guides back the waves of the Tyrrhenian Sea to break against the rough pumice cliffs. You must be wise. Pour the wine and enclose in this brief circle your long-cherished hope. Book 1, Ode 11. We started out with the image of time that is familiar to us, something that flows uniformly and equally throughout the universe, in the course of which all things happen. With the idea that there exists throughout the cosmos a present, a now that constitutes reality. The past for everyone is fixed, is gone, having already happened. The future is open, yet to be determined. Reality flows from the past, through the present, towards the future. And the evolution of things between past and future is intrinsically asymmetrical. This, we thought, is the basic structure of the world. This familiar picture has fallen apart, has shown itself to be only an approximation of a much more complex reality. A present that is common throughout the whole universe does not exist. See Chapter 3. Events are not ordered in pasts, presents, and futures. They are only partially ordered. There is a present that is near to us, but nothing that is present in a far-off galaxy. The present is a localized rather than a global phenomenon. The difference between past and future does not exist in the elementary equations that govern events in the world. See Chapter 2. It issues only from the fact that in the past, the world found itself subject to a state that with our blurred take on things, appears particular to us. Locally, time passes at different speeds according to where we are, and at what speed we ourselves are moving. The closer we are to a mass, see Chapter 1, or the faster we move, see Chapter 3, the more time slows down. There is no single duration between two events. There are many possible ones. The rhythms at which time flows are determined by the gravitational field, a real entity with its own dynamic that is described in the equations of Einstein. If we overlook quantum effects, time and space are aspects of a great jelly in which we are immersed. See Chapter 4. But the world is a quantum one, and gelatinous space-time is also an approximation. In the elementary grammar of the world, there is neither space nor time, only processes that transform physical quantities from one to another, from which it is possible to calculate probabilities and relations. See Chapter 5. At the most fundamental level that we currently know of, therefore, there is little that resembles time as we experience it. There is no special variable time. There is no difference between past and future. There is no space-time. See part two. We still know how to write equations that describe the world. In those equations, the variables evolve with respect to each other. See chapter 8. It is not a static world or a block universe where all change is illusory. See chapter 7. On the contrary, ours is a world of events rather than of things. See chapter 6. This was the outward leg of the journey towards a universe without time. The return journey has been the attempt to understand how, from this world without time, it is possible for our perception of time to emerge. See chapter 9. The surprise has been that, in the emergence of familiar aspects of time, we ourselves have had a role to play. From our perspective, the perspective of creatures who make up a small part of the world, we see that world flowing in time. Our interaction with the world is partial, which is why we see it in a blurred way. To this blurring is added quantum indeterminacy. The ignorance that follows from this determines the existence of a particular variable, thermal time, see chapter 9, and of an entropy that quantifies our uncertainty. Perhaps we belong to a particular subset of the world that interacts with the rest of it in such a way that this entropy is lower in one direction of our thermal time. The directionality of time is therefore real but perspectival. See chapter 10. The entropy of the world in relation to us increases with our thermal time. We see the occurrence of things ordered in this variable, which we simply call time, and the growth of entropy distinguishes the past from the future for us and leads to the unfolding of the cosmos. It determines the existence of traces, residues, and memories of the past. See chapter 11. We human beings are an effect of this great history of the increase of entropy, held together by memory that is enabled by these traces. Each one of us is a unified being because we reflect the world, because we have formed an image of a unified entity by interacting with our kind, and because it is a perspective on the world unified by memory. See chapter 12. From this comes what we call the flowing of time. This is what we are listening to when we listen to the passing of time. The variable time is one of many variables which describe the world. It is one of the variables of the gravitational field. See chapter 4. At our scale, we do not register quantum fluctuations. See chapter 5. Hence it is possible to think of space-time as determined as Einstein's great mollusk. At our scale, the movements of the mollusk are small and can be overlooked. Hence we can think of space-time as being as rigid as a table. This table has dimensions, the one that we call space, and the one along which entropy grows, called time. In our everyday life, we move at low speeds in relation to the speed of light, and so we do not perceive the discrepancies between the different proper times of different clocks, and the differences in speed at which time passes at different distances from a mass are too small for us to distinguish. In the end, therefore, instead of many possible times, we can speak only of a single time, the time of our experience, uniform, universal, and ordered. This is the approximation of an approximation of an approximation of a description of the world made from our particular perspective as human beings who are dependent on the growth of entropy anchored to the flowing of time. We, for whom, as Ecclesiastes has it, there is a time to be born and a time to die. This is time for us, a multi-layered complex concept with multiple distinct properties deriving from various different approximations. Many discussions of the concept of time are confused because they simply do not recognize its complex and multi-layered aspect. They make the mistake of not seeing that the different layers are independent. This is the physical structure of time as I understand it after a lifetime of revolving around it. Many parts of this story are solid, others plausible, others still are guesses hazarded in an attempt at understanding the whole. Practically all the things recounted in the first part of the book have been